ladies and gentlemen. Welcome, wrestling fans worldwide, to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I am the great Ryan Last. It's a pleasure to be with you once again as the Tennessee Stud takes us down the road of wrestling history, sharing his personal tales with all of us, the listeners of the Studcast. Without any further ado, the man himself, the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. Ron, we've had so many great stories coming from this period of time in Florida, but today we're going to really take it up a notch.
Yeah, we're going to talk world championship match. It'll be my first one, and since I started in the profession, I'm about 23 months in. And I have an opportunity, the first time, to wrestle any world champion, either former world champion or a present world champion at this point. And I'm going to be wrestling Dory Funk Jr. in West Palm Beach. And it's an exciting time for a young wrestler when he gets that first title shot. It means several different things. And one of them is that you're going places and it's kind of what you work for as a young guy. And West Palm Beach is the perfect place for me to get this match. It's actually on May 8th in 1972 at the West Palm Beach Auditorium. It's another one of those sellouts that we had done a series of sellouts with Bobby Shane. And we come back and have another big sellout with Dory Funk Jr. here. And it's an extremely exciting time for a young wrestler, and it's really odd. What happens is in this case, I had never met Dory Jr. I had seen him wrestle many, many times against mostly Jack Briscoe matches. But, you know, when you sit down with a guy for the first time and you never had an opportunity to meet him, and you talk about, you know, his family is such a historic family, kind of similar to mine, except, you know, there's two brothers there and they're both world champions. Can't do much better than that. But we have a whole lot in common. And we've discussed a lot of that prior to going into the ring. And so it's a great experience for me. And I have watched so many of the matches, his matches with Jack Briscoe, watched them work together many, many times. Actually what happens is they work together so often that I, like all the other wrestlers, I find myself at the end of the card. If I'm second match, third match, back in those days, I'm fairly early on the card. This may be the sixth or seventh match. And I find myself backing up against the wall somewhere in the dark and actually watching the match. And it's not just me. A lot of times I would do that when I was young, and I'd be the only guy. But when those two guys wrestled, there was a lot of bodies along those walls. They stayed for the entire card. You used to jump out of there and leave when you got your match done. But when it's Jack Briscoe and Dory Funk Jr. In that last match, you want to see it if you're a young guy. And if you want to go places and you want to learn things, there you're looking at a couple of the all-time greats right there. And so So that's kind of where we're headed today. We're going to talk in pretty much detail about this opportunity and how it was to work with Dory Jr., how it was to work with a world champion. And I think a great place for us to start, Brian, maybe with just a brief history of the NWA title as it concerns both of these two guys. Dory Jr. won the world championship on February 11th in 1969. Jack wrestled him many times, many, many times. I don't know. I saw all the Florida matches. I didn't see a whole lot of the matches that took place maybe in St. Louis, in other parts. Maybe Jack goes out to Amarillo. I don't know what goes on in those matches, but I do know that Jack never beats Dory for the world title. Dory's not going to lose that championship until 1973. He's going to keep that championship for four straight years. And on May 24th in 73, he's going to lose it to Harley Race. Less than 2 months later, on July 20th in 73, Harley is going to drop it to Jack. And so that kind of gives fans an idea of who was world champion basically in this time frame, and how these two wrestlers, Jack Briscoe and Dory Funk Jr., really kind of dominated the sport in that time frame.
Ron, who's the first world champion you remember? And also, who was your favorite world champion up until you got into the business?
The first one I ever remember, the first world championship match that I remember is Gene Koninsky wrestling my dad in Atlanta. That was a pretty brutal match. Gene's a pretty tough dude, and Dad took it to him. It was a really, really great match. I believe they wrestled an hour, and that was pretty much the way things went at this time. I really liked several of the world champions, and Dory happens to be one of my favorite world champions because he's so different in the way he worked, and his style is so great. I really like Dory, the first world champion that other than wrestling Dory here for the first time, I wrestled Lou Thesz pretty early in my career. And that's a wrestling lesson for darn sure. You learn a lot when you wrestle a guy like him. But I really like Dory. I think Dory epitomized what professional wrestling was all about. And so I'd like to kind of start out just maybe describing the style in my first match with him, what I found Dory's style to be. I had an idea, obviously, of his style. I had seen enough matches with him and Jack. A lot of those matches were one-hour matches, and they went, everybody in the business calls it Broadway. You go the whole 60. It's a real grind. It's what makes great wrestlers is those Broadways. That's kind of a thing of the past. I don't think they do it anywhere anymore. And used to do quite a bit of it. I'd already had a couple of them, but I wasn't wrestling Dory Jr. I was wrestling guys that were not nearly as good as he was. So let me just kind of break down his style a little bit. Dory was always a master of holds and reversals. He seemed to know every hold in wrestling. You very seldom saw, and he liked to utilize them. A lot of guys know a lot of holds, but they get into a habit of just using some of those holds, and their repertoire does not remain big like it should. And with him as world champion, he kept that repertoire, and he'd take those holds and they'd go real smoothly from a headlock, take a headlock, take you over, you scissor him. He'd quickly reverse the scissor and come up with sometimes with your legs behind your back. I mean, he had all these reversals and all these holds down. He was a fabulous technician. He was a smooth and beautiful in the ring, I thought. He called a great match. He called a great net match that night. And he called great matches all the time. He seemed to have the ability that some guys just never seem to develop. He just had a perfect timing about him. He knew when it was time to sell and when it was time for a guy to make a comeback. He knew when to get out of one hole and start to work for, instead of an arm, go to a leg. I mean, he just seemed to have all of that great. He loved to do suplexes. He'd do all kinds of suplexes. He would do the belly to back. He would do the double arm sometimes. He would do the vertical suplex. And those are fabulous moves. Young guy like me, been wrestling less than 2 years. I have an opportunity. I actually learned to do the double arm suplex in this match. I'd never done it before. He called it and I did it. And I found out with my height and with my size, I could rocket a guy pretty good when you hook those arms behind his back and you go backwards and sling him into the air. I remember doing it to Tim Woods in a match in Tampa. And after it was over, he was a little pissed at me. You know, he's like, "Hey, geez, man, that hurt." You know, I go, "Well, hell, you know, I didn't do it any different. I normally do it." But so, you know, it was an opportunity to really experience most everything. And we did a whole lot of pretty much everything during the course of the match. I liked one thing he did, and very few guys do this. You see the English guys do it quite a bit, is Dory didn't like to throw punches. He liked to use that forearm, and he could really lay that forearm in there. And it, to me, is a beautiful move. It's a very good way to get a little bit of heat without actually cheating, you know, and that really, in my opinion, made Dory different than just about any world champion. The fact that Dory could actually go out there and work with either a babyface or a heel. And it's hard to think of another world champion that had the ability to do that. Luthez, possibly. Pat O'Connor, maybe. You know, but very few guys have that ability. And when you use that forearm rather than throwing punches, you don't become the dirty heel. You don't get that huge crowd reaction, and they don't boo you as badly. But it actually becomes a phenomenal move to use rather than a punch. Because so many matches go to the fight rather than the wrestling match, that forearm keeps it on that wrestling level. And I thought that was one of his greatest attributes, the way he used it, why he used it, and how it worked for him as compared to other people. Obviously, I was very much taken with the fantastic shape he is in. And it's, you know, very, very difficult to wrestle in one of those hour matches. And that sucker, you got to thinking about it. He's wrestling 7 nights a week, probably 6 at least. And I'll bet you 5 of those are 1 hour matches. After you do that for a while, you just get in phenomenal shape. And it, you know, when you go those broadways like that, It made your talent look good. When he came in and he would do the Broadway with Jack and he would do the Broadway with me, it got me over more because he didn't beat me, and it never hurt him, I thought, because he kept himself over because he didn't get beat, obviously. So that alone is a style that's kind of totally different than any other world champion I can think of off the top of my head.
You mentioned his timing earlier. How much of the timing do you think is just growing up around wrestling? From the time that you're a small child, you're always around wrestling, you're always watching, you're always seeing what works and what doesn't work and feeling it with the crowd because you're actually there. I mean, you were a kid who grew up around wrestling. What do you think?
Oh, you're right about that. I mean, and Dory obviously is just like me. He grew up watching his dad and watching others. I watched not only my dad, my granddad and Herb and Roy and Lester and, you know, the Fields brothers. I watched them all wrestle. And timing is, you sometimes guys never learn it. You can't It's just an intuition that you have as a wrestler as to when it's time to take over, when it's time to sell. All of those things are so important in painting that picture that you're trying to paint when the bell rings, to be able to finish at the end of it and people go home going, wow, I've never seen anything like that. And that's what you want to create out there. And timing is a whole lot of that. If your timing is off and you're doing the wrong things at the wrong time, you can take a great match and you can wreck it halfway through or three quarters of the way through. I never saw him wreck one. I never saw him had any problem, no matter who he was wrestling, in keeping that match moving along and being able to get the heat when he wanted it and being able to get the comeback when he wanted it. He was excellent at calling that match.
When the NWA champion comes into town, do they always call the match? And the second part of this question, by this point in your career, 1972, are you calling any matches?
Well, that's a good point. I don't call matches at this point. No, I don't. And what happens in most of the time in wrestling back in those days, it was the deal. You knew it when you went in the ring, the heel calls the match. The babyface rarely called the match unless the babyface is very experienced and he's got a young heel. And the heel doesn't know how to call the match, and the babyface can take over and call the match. My first couple of years, I'm working in Florida. I'm working in a great territory. I'm working with tremendous heels. I don't need to call the match. I just want to learn, man. I don't want to screw anything up. I just want those guys to teach me. And every time you go in the ring, you're working with these great workers, you're getting a wrestling lesson. If you open your mouth and you want to lead, it's like an insult to some of those guys. I would never insult them. You just, as a young guy, 2 years in, I didn't know enough to lead a great match, but I did start to learn some things from it. And that's, you know, as a description of the match itself, this particular match to me, and describing it in one word, it's exhausting. It's my first Broadway with a world champion, and I'm nervous, which is to be expected. I'm in a town in which they're pushing me, and I'm over. I've got a sell out there, and I don't want to disappoint people. And I, during the day of the match, I'm actually nervous all day long. I'm thinking about it and I'm like, wow, geez, it affects you. And what it does is it affects your breathing. You don't even realize it, but when you start as a very young wrestler and in your first couple of months, you find yourself being blown up in the first 5 minutes. You haven't done anything. It's because you're just holding your breath. You're not breathing. So I go into this match and I'm really concerned about doing well and having a great match. And these nerves are taking it out of me. I learned so many things, but that's one of the things that happened. And a lot of the spots he calls, they're fast spots. There are lots of fast up and down spots. Tackle, leapfrog, drop down, drop kick, arm drag. If you're in an arm drag sequence and you're doing these spots like that, he's calling four or five different moves at a time. You end up with the arm again. It's going to make you look good, but it's also going to tire you out. And as our match progresses, that weariness just gets worse and worse. So what happened to me in this match is this early nervousness that I had, it led to a lot of lost energy. And then what happens is you come to the last 5 minutes, and that's crucial. It's critical to a Broadway. The last 5 minutes, you have to save yourself for that because you're going to exert so much energy in that last 5 minutes. Sometimes when I think about it, I equate it to the last 5 minutes. You exert as much energy as the first 55 minutes. It's just exhausting. And so That's my taking from this match. I really learned a lot about that. I should have saved myself. I should have saved my lungs. I should have saved my activity and everything else. And I would have probably had a better match. Although we end up with a great match, an absolutely fabulous match. And I had fans for years afterward tell me they saw that match and how great it was. I learned in that match, is like, I learned really how to slow down and sell being tired. One thing that Dory was really good at, a lot of champions are good at this. Harley was very good at it too, is being able to take a bump and being able to sell that bump and not get back on your feet too quickly. Let the fans realize how hard the bump was that you took and then slowly regain your feet. The match kind of slows itself down. When it slows itself down, every move has more impact. So the fans just get into it more and more. As the speed of the match slows, you start fast, you're slowing. By the time you get into that last 5 minutes, you need to really be selling everything that happens in there in order to be able to make it work. Also learned in that match how to milk bumps, how to milk every bump to get the most out of it. You had a tendency as a young wrestler not to sell much. You'd take these bumps, big bumps, and you'd be back on your feet too quick. But what you do is you follow him, and his lead is not just in what he says. His lead is in how he reacts. So when you take a bump with him, I would roll over and watch him. And he might lay there longer than I even dreamed about doing it. But then I realize, okay, it gives me an opportunity to rest. And secondly, it gives me an opportunity to take the match to another level. So all these things are fabulous when you're a young guy. These opportunities to learn these things are great. And you learn how to set the pace for a match. That's really important because years later, I'm going to turn into a heel. And this match for me kind of really gave me a feel for how to set the pace for a 1 hour match when you're a heel. He called a great match and how to make your opponent look good and not hurt your own ability to draw money. That's a classic thought for wrestlers that make it to the big time, is how can you look good and not hurt yourself and not win? You know, sometimes you don't win, but you need to not hurt yourself by losing. And for me, it was really difficult because I was big and I was tall, and I had to learn how and when to make the moves that I needed to make in order to make an impression on the fans, even if I wasn't going to win that match. I also learned how to make the last 5 minutes spectacular. And that, like I said, is crucial. You're going to do that 1 hour. The last 5 minutes of that match has to be standing them up. And that night in that building, I don't think there was anybody in their seat in the last 5 minutes. Now, a lot of that credit goes to him, obviously, but it was a phenomenal experience for me. Guys used to always say with me when they wrestled me that sometimes I get these goosebumps, and heels were always scared. When I got the goosebumps, they wanted to exit. They won't get on the floor sometimes. And I had a lot of goosebumps in the last 5 minutes of this title match.
At that time in the business, what was the reputation of the Dory Funk Jack Briscoe series? Because you look at it now and it looks so far ahead of so much of what footage is available of wrestling from that time. But in that time, in 1972, what are people saying about those two in their matches?
Gosh, I assume they're saying the same thing I am. They were the greatest wrestling matches I ever saw. They were absolutely phenomenal. And like I said, they did not punch. Jack was just a fabulous wrestler. I mean, Jack was legit. I mean, he was a fabulous amateur wrestler and just as good as a pro. And when you put those two guys together, it was an experience. Fans came to see them, and they wrestled a whole lot. And some people used to ask me, well, why is it Jack always wrestles Dory? And, you know, when me being a fan somewhat in one sense, I'm standing and watching these matches every time they go at it. It was an easy answer because they have the greatest matches anybody's ever seen. I mean, why would you book him, Dory, with anybody else? I'm lucky to get a title shot because they're going to give that thing to Jack, and deservedly so. So it was really a feather in my cap to get the chance to wrestle Dory in the state of Florida and then pass over Jack to give me that shot. And it helped me dramatically to make my presence in that city as a star. Legitimate. Fans, after that match, says, geez, Ron, you almost beat the world champion. You're just as good as the world champion. And that's what you want to come out with when you lose in one of these important matches like this. You want to come out with the fans saying, wow, you know, you're just great. And he did it for me. I mean, that wasn't me that did it. I give all the credit to Dory. Dory made me look good. And it made a bond when you have a great match with anybody. I don't care who it is. It creates a bond between the two guys. There's a feeling of camaraderie with that guy that you didn't have before because you've had that fantastic match.
What were your overall impressions of Dory as the NWA champion?
Like I said, I think he's one of the all-time greats. And I worked with Dory a whole bunch of times. They weren't always world championship matches. I worked with Dory several times after that. The last time I ever worked with Dory was in the Cayman Islands in the Caribbean. And we wrestled probably 45-minute match that night. And my impression and of Dory never changed. His ability never changed. I wrestled Dory in Japan in 83, and Dory's still Dory. He's still doing his thing, and I thought his thing was wonderful. I thought it did so much for the wrestling business because it was wrestling, the name on the marquee. It wasn't any fight. It wasn't any punching. It wasn't any hair pulling. It wasn't any eye gouging. It wasn't any low blows. He didn't have to resort to any of that. He kept it to wrestling and just stood them on their feet. That, to me, was what it was all about.
During this period of time, obviously, things are going really well for you because they don't just give NWA title shots to anybody. Who else are you working with around this period of time in the spring of 1972?
I work with, gosh, a lot of dudes. I work with Bearcat Wright. Bearcat Wright, his name was really Edward Wright. He's 6'6". He's almost my size. He's almost my height. He is the son of a boxer. His dad's name was Ed Wright. And Bearcat boxed a little bit, I guess, before he became a wrestler. In fact, I saw somewhere where he had an 8-0 record at one time. He was a creditable boxer, obviously. And his background is really unique and different than a whole lot of guys. He's credited along with Sputnik Monroe with, kind of being a force when it comes to the desegregation of wrestling. Now we talked about Sputnik a lot in Studcast, way back in the day when he was wrestling in Memphis with my dad. We're going to talk about him in this episode, as a matter of fact. But Sputnik just changed wrestling in Memphis. Memphis is a huge black population, and Sputnik's a white guy, which is difficult for him to be able to do that. In Bearcat's case, he's a big black dude, and he's a great worker, and he's a role model for those people, and Sputnik is too. Sputnik as a white guy is a role model for those people. So he really helps And Bearcat does the same thing as Sputnik. He's really a great spokesman for opening the sport and black being people's being able to sit where white people do and it not being a problem. And gosh, it was where we all needed to go. These guys were ahead of their time. Bearcat worked a whole lot with Bobo Brazil. They had a lot of tag matches, and Bearcat was he was a strange guy. He had an incident in 1963 in which, and this is fairly rare, he refused to drop the title in Los Angeles to who the promoters wanted him to drop the title to. That in itself is a pretty unique thing to happen, and I think they wanted him to drop, and WWA, that's what that area of Los Angeles down there, he was WWA champion, and they wanted him to put Freddie Blassie over. Freddie Blassie's a huge card in Los Angeles. I've worked in the Olympic. Not in Freddie Blassie's time, but there was a time in the 60s when Freddie Blassie was a monster card there. And for whatever reason, Bearcat Wright decides that he doesn't want to put the title, he don't want to put the strap on Freddie. And so I assume that, you know, and I heard this story, that there was probably a discussion in the dressing room. Freddie was not a shooter. Freddie was a great guy, tremendous heel, but a really, really nice guy, and just didn't have those qualities about him. And I don't know whether Bearcat could shoot or anything either, but somehow I'm sure they said, we want you to do a job for Freddie here, and Bearcat says no. So one of the promoters that's in Los Angeles at the time, there's two brothers. There's Gene and Mike LaBelle. Gene is a bona fide judo champion and can shoot a little bit. So there's a conversation, I assume, in the dressing room. Now, I wasn't privy to this, but I've heard about it. And the conversation went such that Bearcat says, no, I'm not going to put him over. And so they say, okay, well, then we'll see what happens when you go to the ring. Well, that happens sometimes. So what happens then is Gene LaBelle, he goes and puts on his tights, and Freddie don't go to the ring. So when Bearcat goes to the ring, Gene's standing there in the ring. Now Bearcat's on the way down there, and he's got to now consider, well, this guy can shoot, you know, and what is going to happen to me if I get in that ring? And so he comes down the aisle, and he gets almost to the ring, and decides that, hey, you know, I think I'm just going to turn around and go back. And so when that happens, they count him out, and he forfeits the belt. They go back to the dressing room. Somebody goes back there and gets the belt, and they bring it to the ring, and they give it to Gene LaBelle. So those things don't happen too much in wrestling. And it's kind of like a, you know, some people would consider it a black eye, but it wasn't a black eye enough so that Bearcat Wright got inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame, in spite of that little problem in 1963. And he was a great worker. He was a very good worker. And in the match I had with him, and I only worked with him once, we had a great match because we were so similar in height and similar in size. And I thought he was a great heel. He could get really good heat. And so that's one of the guys I work with. I work with Frankie Kane. Another guy comes to mind. Frankie Kane, his real name was James Ault. Far away from Frankie Kane. Some guys kind of pick names that are similar to theirs. And he worked as the Great Mephisto. Later on, when I knew him, in the mid-60s, he formed a tag team with a guy out of East Tennessee that lived in the Tri-Cities, not Johnson City, Kingsport, and Bristol, Tennessee, Rocky Smith, who was a great worker, a tremendous worker. And Rocky Smith got to liking Frankie, and they had a referee in that part of the country named Jimmy Dykes. He's a red-haired guy, kind of a small, a creepy looking dude. And they say, why don't we start a tag team? The two of them, and they said, let's take this referee who was fair talker. And they decide that they're going to make a manager out of him. So they create the Infernos. And they put J.C. Dykes. They don't call him Jimmy. They call him J.C. Dykes. One of the great tag teams of all time. Frankie Kane is a tremendous worker. Rocky Smith is a tremendous worker. This tag team has a gimmick that is really, really good. And I think maybe one of the first people to ever use it, they used the loaded boot gimmick. Rocky Smith was the guy that always had the loaded boot. Rocky Smith had his right foot, the sole on the shoe of his wrestling boot was about 3 inches high, about 2 inches. It was obviously higher than the sole on his left shoe. And what Rocky would do is at the right time when they weren't ready to get to the finish, Rocky would, the referee, get the back referee's back turn, and Rocky would tap that foot on his toe on the mat real hard and supposedly load that boot. And that's the way they won a whole lot of matches. And that's the way they probably had a lot of riots in Tennessee and places like that. They spent a lot of time in the Tennessee in that early mid-60s era. And then in 1970, Frankie decides to remove his mask and he starts working as the Great Mephisto. Frankie's a great worker. He works for me in Knoxville at Southeastern Wrestling in 1976. I loved working with him, and not only was he a great worker, but he had the ability to do finishes. He would have made a good booker, and later on, as time goes by, he is going to try his hand at booking, and he's going to try to become an owner. I was very impressed with Frankie Kane. I thought Frankie Kane, after he left Knoxville, could go any place he wanted to work, and he could probably run business for some people.
He was someone a lot of people considered a great booking mind.
Yes, he had that ability, and I never let him do any booking. But he's one of those guys, if you ever gave him the opportunity, you said, Frankie, what do you think? And I like to do that because you get ideas that you don't have yourself. Sometimes they're brilliant. Sometimes they're fantastic. But even if they're not, I love to do it with young guys. I want to push them. I wanted to push them to think the business. And that's the way you start them thinking about, wow, what if I did this? And what if that were to happen? And so then you start thinking about angles, and then you start thinking about programs. And it's just part of what the business is all about. I kind of had a reputation. In fact, in the last Super Studcast we did with Honky Tonk and with Kevin, I mean, we kind of discussed that I like to let my young guys go. I like to give them their head, and I like to make them think. I wanted them to not just come to the building and wait and say, tell me what you want me to do. I wanted sometimes to say, what should we do? And I wanted to put them in that position to use their mind to become better. I mean, once you start thinking in those terms, you become a better worker in the ring even.
We will return with more of the Studcast after this word about the latest Super Studcast.
Thousands worldwide are saying the Tennessee Stud is the best wrestling historian alive. His Studcast and Super Studcast are among the top-rated podcasts on planet Earth. Super Studcast number 8 with WWE's Honky Tonk Man and WCW's Kevin Sullivan is continuing a string of 8 great Super Studcasts that all rock at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. All patrons will enjoy the rest of the Honky Tonk Man and Kevin Sullivan story beginning August 28th, when the three superstars will be live on the historic and hysteric third hour of number 8. Saddle up for only $2.99, less than a dollar per hour, and hear for yourself why the world loves the Tennessee Stud.
There you hear it, Super Studcast number 8, the Honky Tonk Man and Kevin Sullivan. It was a really good time. What a show. We have heard such a great reaction from so many people. And the rest of the story coming at you very soon. Of course, all available at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast only. $2.99 more later in the program. But Ron, let's return to Florida. Let's return there in the spring of 1972. Who else are you working with?
Well, there's a lot of great wrestlers in Florida at that point. One of them is a guy named Mike Webster. He's out of Canada. And it's a pretty strange coincidence. Mike Webster is he's a football player. He played football for Notre Dame, and he's a Canadian. So he goes back to Canada and becomes a professional football player, has a great career as a football player in Canada, and they actually win a Grey Cup. He's one of the members of the Grey Cup team. There's another Mike Webster, you know, that was a center for the Pittsburgh Steelers, that was a Hall of Famer, all pro, same guys, and they're both football players. So, you know, it's kind of ironic. You got both guys, same name, and both of them, you know, played the same game. Mike Webster is a good athlete. He's a big guy, good athlete, has a pretty fair match. You know, he's a heel, obviously. He's calling the match. But he's a much better football player than he is a wrestler. I guess that's a good way for me to put it. And he has his best part of his career is not in wrestling. It's actually on the football field. I wrestled another guy named Smasher Sloan. Eldon Lee Whittler is his name, his actual name. And he's a son of Whitey Whittler, who is a star wrestler in the 1930s. Smasher Sloan he's a son of a wrestler, and Kasha, usually when you get those type of guys, you're going to have some good talent. They're going to have a feel for business that other people just never seem to get, because I guess they grow up in the sport like I did, and they're watching it so much. He won a lot of different tag titles, and he had his most success with partners with Don Jardine under Gary Hart in 1968 and 69. They won several different tag championships around the country. Other guys that were there at that time frame I wrestled was Doug Gilbert, who was the professional, spent a lot of time in Georgia, was a big star in Georgia, big star also in Florida. Dennis Hall. I wrestled Dennis Hall in this time frame. Dennis Hall works for me in Knoxville. I love Dennis Hall. Great guy. Mike George, pretty darn good athlete himself. Worked a lot out in the Mid-South area for Bill Watts, kind of that Oklahoma time frame. And then the great Malenko. The great Malenko, gosh. He's synonymous with wrestling in Florida. His and Eddie Graham's matches are legendary. One of the all-time great stars in Florida, and he has sons that go on to have great wrestling careers as well. So I'm kind of getting a taste of a little bit of everybody here, and then on top of all that, I occasionally fly out in the middle of that summer on July 3rd, 1972. I catch a plane and I fly to Memphis, and I'm going to work with my brother, who's wrestling in Tennessee at that time. I'm going to work a Texas Tornado match, a six-man Texas Tornado match. All six guys in the ring at the same time. It's me, my brother, and Sputnik Munro against the Von Bronners. Kurt and Carl Von Bronner and Saul, their manager, is actually in the ring as a wrestler. Wow, you talk about changing gears. When you go to Tennessee during this time frame and you leave Florida, you're leaving wrestling and you're going into pandemonium. You go there expecting to fight. Now, I've had 6 months or earlier or so, I have a little run there for a couple of weeks, and I find out that, wow, what they do in one territory can be totally different than what they do in others. And this is another great example of what that happens. What happens for me is I get myself into that six-man Texas Tornado match, and it's wild and crazy. A lot of blood in it. It's not me that's bleeding, but pretty much everybody else in the ring is. And it's the way they do business. It's just the difference between the two territories. Kind of crazy, but that's what it is.
If you were booking, who do you think you would want? Who was the stronger act? Would you take Saul Weingroff and the Von Brauners or J.C. Dykes and the Infernos?
That's a great question, Brian. They're two different teams. They're two totally different teams. The Von Brauners are hosses. They're magnificent specimens. They have great bodies. Their style is totally different than the Infernos. They're slow. They like to take a hold. They like to keep you on the mat. And Saul is a totally different manager type than J.C. Dykes. The Infernos, they are a moving team. They are a bump takers. They're up and down. They're called lots of high spots. It's a different, totally different type of match. I really love the Infernos. I work with them a bunch. And when Frankie quits with the Infernos and becomes Mephisto, then Rocky Smith goes and gets his brother Curtis Smith to become the other Inferno. And J.C. Dykes obviously stays with that team, and they wrestle a lot in Florida during this time frame. They're involved in a lot of matches, and I've wrestled them quite a few times. The Von Brauners have a presence in the ring. They have charisma, I guess, like everybody used to say about Dusty. Dusty was saying himself, charisma, I got it. You know, well, they had a certain charisma about those Von Brauners. When those guys came down to the ring and they stepped through those ropes and they stood up tall and straight, people were impressed. I didn't care who they were. They thought, wow, these guys are physical specimens, and they really were.
You mentioned getting to experience so many different types of styles and so many different wrestlers you got to work with. It's around this time the Australians came into Florida, correct?
Yeah, it is. Actually, you know, we've already talked a little bit. We had one trip to Australia in which I was only there for about 2 weeks. And my dad was there even longer, and he and Jim Barnett, are creating a relationship with one another. And I'm there for 2 weeks, enough time to meet some of these young Aussies that are doing jobs for the Americans. And Barnett liked to bring his crew in, not just from America, but he liked Milano from Italy, and he liked Spiros Arion from Greece. He liked Sabu Singh from India. I mean, he would bring talent from all over the world, and the Aussies were doing jobs for them. Well, these Aussies, some of them are becoming good. They're becoming stars in their own right. They're not being put over at this point in Australia. They're still just doing jobs. But there are some of them that Dad really likes, and he talks to Eddie when he comes back. In 71, we're in Australia, and he talks him into bringing a few of those guys in. Two of them in particular is Ron Miller and Larry O'Day. They are going to become, I don't know, you probably know more about this than I do. I believe that when Barnett leaves Australia, I believe those are going to be a couple of the dudes that are going to be running business there, probably booking, and I don't know, maybe even being partial owners at that point. So they come, and then these guys can wrestle. They've been wrestling team in Australia quite a bit. So they come to Florida, and pretty quickly they become Florida tag champions. And they've got that great Aussie accent, and you know, they can really do it. They're bad out there in the ring, you know. So then you've got Tony Garea and Johnny Gray. Johnny Gray is a young kid, Tony Garea is a little better built and a little better body. Tony Garea goes up there for Vince Senior, and it becomes a star in the WWF. Johnny Gray falls off with Bill Dundee, who's going to come into Memphis pretty much in this same time frame. And George Barnes is going to come into Memphis in the same time frame. So you've got Aussies now not just wrestling in Australia, but they're starting to come to other places in the country. Part of the reason that Gurria goes there and that Dundee and George Barnes go to Memphis is because of Dad's influence there. Dad's involved with Georgia. He's involved with Florida. He's involved with Tennessee. So he's trying to help these Aussies get their feet wet in America and really learn the game and learn the business. And that's what happens. They start showing up. You got some of them in Florida. You got some of them in Tennessee. You got one that goes to New York. Things are happening for those guys.
Who is the best worker of the Australians? George Barnes?
I really like George Barnes. When we get to Australia, which is going to be fairly soon here, I've got one phenomenal story about George Barnes. George Barnes, in my opinion, with one match, singly changed Australia's way of looking at their own country's wrestlers forever. I love to tell the story, but I don't want to get too far away from what we're doing here. And Florida's just got all this great stuff going on. I want to talk just a quick little bit about Grizzly Smith. I'm running another spot show. Last spot show I ran was Spelgully, Florida. We had a bomb threat. We got it's just so much going on that night there Dick Murdoch, is wearing the damn pith helmet around and leading the bomb squad. And it's just a lot of things, funny things going on. So we run the next spot show I run is Fort Pierce, Florida. Belgrade's about 50 miles east of West Palm. Fort Pierce is about 50 miles north of West Palm. And we run in another armory. Armories are the place to run back in those days. They have bleachers usually on one side, sometimes both sides. They have their own chairs so that they can set you up for any event. They could do other things other than wrestling, but wrestling happens to fit well in these armories. So I've put us a show in Fort Pierce, and we sell that sucker out, totally sell it out. Way too many people, kind of like Belgrade, way more than what the army should hold. And the same guy named Mac, who was selling the tickets in Belgrade, and they once the bomb scare takes place, and the gentleman says, "Don't panic, but there's a bomb in the building," and everybody rushes out and blows him out in his ticket booth out front. Well, he's selling tickets again this night. And I kind of want to tell this story because he's becomes an important figure in my life down the road. He's going to help me get my first wrestling company. And he's selling tickets that night, and he has saved two ringside tickets for friends of his from West Palm. And there's probably as many people outside this armory as there are inside. He's selling in a small area by the front door. Once he sells the ticket to the people, they go right through the front door and into the armory. Well, he and this booth, it's not a booth, it's a open area, but there's a gate that he pulls in front of him. It slides back and forth, and it's kind of got just squares of wire there that are probably 4-inch squares that people can see him through there. And he pulls the thing through, and I come out. I have a way to getting out of the dressing room so I can get into the room where he is. And I go in there and I hear him, and people are all just begging for tickets. They're like 15 deep. And they're, "Please, please, please." And he said, "No, go away, go away, go away. We're sold out. We're sold out." And he's not being real, real nice to him. And I kind of like, I kind of like pull him off, "Hey man, you need to be a little nicer to him. It's a shame they can't get them all in." "Well, okay. So he goes back, and now they're upset with him. They're mad. And so finally, while I'm still standing there, I back up so people can't see me. And he sees his two friends from West Palm, and he jumps up and he grabs the gate in front of him, and he slides it back, and he holds the tickets up over his head, and he goes, hey, here we go, here I am, here's your two tickets. And one of those guys that had been standing there listening to his insults for 30 minutes pops him right in the eye. Pow! Down he goes in the floor. He grabs the two ringside tickets and goes in the building. So my friend Mac, he gets up. He's got a busted eye. It's kind of like his experience in Belgrade. And he goes, you got any way I can fix my eye here, man? Can you give me can you fix my face for me? So, you know, he's had his second little inroad. He's going to get his eyes busted in the next 3 or 4 months, probably more than any of the wrestlers in the territory. So, it's a normal deal for him. And, if we got time, I'd like to tell one little story on Grizzly Smith. Yeah. How are we doing for time?
I think we got time for one more story. Sure, Ron.
Okay. Grizzly Smith. I don't know if people know Grizzly. I know they're going to know his sons, but, Grizzly Smith, his real name is Aurelian, which is a funny name, and Grizzly's a funny guy. Grizzly Smith, he's 6'8". He's my height, and he weighs 350 pounds. He starts in 58. He starts out west. Actually, he works in the oil fields and does some wrestling at the same time. Takes me right back to my grandfather, Roy, who started in Borger, Texas, and worked in the oil fields and trained with Dutch Mantell, and you know, goes from there to becoming a wrestler. Well, Grizzly starts in that same way. He works in the oil fields and he's wrestling part time. He's a big, huge guy. He works tag partners with Don Leo Jonathan. I love Don Leo Jonathan. We've talked about Don Leo Jonathan some, and they win the Canadian tag titles in Vancouver, the NWA Canadian titles in Gene Koninsky's territory, out there in Vancouver, from the Assassins of all teams. I never realized the Assassins are out there in Vancouver, but they are. They have worked out in there some. Grizzly, after he retires, retires from the ring. He becomes a road agent for WWE, and he ends up promoting a few towns in Louisiana. He works for Big Bill Watts in Mid-South. He's still around the business. Now, Grizzly in himself is not much of a story, but Grizzly has two sons. And I think fans, if they don't know who I'm about to say, are probably going to go, wow, I never knew that. One of his sons is Jake the Snake Roberts. Gosh, huge star, monster star, Sam Houston. If you're a Texas fan out there, you've seen quite a bit of Sam Houston. Great young kid, fabulous talent. And Jake has a daughter, and oddly enough, his daughter's a wrestler as well. Her name is Rockin' Robin, and she works a whole lot in Japan, of all places. He goes to Japan, and he kind of gets her involved in Japan and everything. And the reason I want to talk Grizzly here is because Grizzly he's not there very long when I go there to Florida. I remember that Grizzly had a very funny thing about him. He was one of those people that if you goosed him, if you took your thumb and you stuck him toward the rear end, or you just goose him in the side or wherever, he would go crazy. He would start swinging his arms and he would start screaming and shouting. And the first time I saw it, he almost hit me in the head. He took a wild ass swing and I just barely ducked it. And I kind of wanted to find a place to hide. I was like, whoa, what's wrong with this guy? So I remember, and he's in this town, Fort Pierce, that night, and he's on the card, and we're in a dressing room that's now it's dark. And someone goes over, and we're all kind of in a little group there together, and it's a small dressing room. It's not made for a dressing room. It's just a little room in which the army people meet. And Grizzly's over there right in the middle of all these people, and somebody reaches over and turns out the light, and they goose Grizzly. And I was like, oh my gosh, you can't see him. It's totally dark, but he's just flailing and screaming with his arms. And I know what it's looking like. Somebody's going to get hurt. you know. And I remember getting under the table that night. And the only place I could find that it was going to be safe for me to get away from it. And so Grizzly was a strange dude. And it's amazing that, you know, one guy maybe doesn't ever become a star, and yet his kids go on to surpass what he does in his lifetime. And that's exactly what happens in Grizzly's case.
Well, Ron, you mentioned time before. We are very short on time, which is unfortunate. We did have a couple questions here this week. One of them I was actually really curious to hear you talk about. We briefly talked about your thoughts about the plane crash in Mid-Atlantic in 1975 with Johnny Valentine and Ric Flair and others. But that was one of the questions. We don't really have time for it here today, but maybe we can begin the show next week with it.
Oh, I'd love to that. I'd love to do that. I mean, I would like to answer it today, but that's a long answer. I mean, you know, I really had a lot of comments about the last Studcast we did about the Bobby Shane tribute. And a lot of people had great comments about that portion of the show. I had one guy that said he mowed the lawn and with headset on and listened to the program. And he said that he had to stop the lawnmower because he started crying at the end of it. I was touched by that, you know. I mean, he said it was just really phenomenal. And I could imagine that maybe we had a question from somebody that heard that and says, you know, tell us about the one in North Carolina. The one in North Carolina is, wow. It's just as equally as sad, but in a different way, and it involves more bodies and more people and more careers. We'll do that. I would like to do that. Maybe we can start next week. We change the format a little bit, and next week we'll start with questions first, and get that taken care of.
That sounds good. I'd like to hear what you have to say. But as we wrap things up, of course, you can keep up with the Tennessee Stud on Facebook. The page, Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. You could also follow the Stud on Instagram and Twitter at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last. You can hear me on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com. Classic wrestling talk and wrestling humor wherever you find your favorite podcast. Search for the 605 Super Podcast. We want to remind you that you can ride through the website tnstud.com for everything Tennessee Stud, from souvenirs to studcasts, and of course the Super Studcast and rest of the story, tnstud.com. And on the topic of the Super Studcast and the rest of the story, become a patron and support all studcasts at either tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Once you become a patron of the show, you get access to all previous Super Studcasts and rest of the story. And number 8 is breaking all sorts of records. Thank you to everyone who has already listened and talked about, of course, the Honky Tonk Man and Kevin Sullivan with the Tennessee Stud. Ron, you mentioned that we will begin next week's show with this question about the plane crash in the Mid-Atlantic. Where else are we going next week?
Well, obviously, we're still in Florida here. We're going to talk about, you know, everybody shows up in Florida, and it's amazing. We're going to talk about one of the absolute greatest tag teams of all time is going to come to Florida, and they're going to stay about a month to 6 weeks. I'm going to have the opportunity to wrestle against them 7 times. And I just relish every one of those. And that's Nick Bockwinkel and Ray Stevens, an absolutely off the charts, fabulous team. We'll talk about another busted eye that Mac gets. We'll bust his eye again next week. And we're going to probably talk about another one of the big spot shows that they let me run, another town that's going to set the all time attendance record for a spot show in the state of Florida. And so we got plenty to talk about next week. And I just want to thank the fans before we get out here, Brian, especially those, the patrons that are helping to support it all. I love all the fans, and I want to thank them all for listening to Studcast, whether they're Super Studcast or regular Studcast. It's just a pleasure to be here and to do what I do. And every week I see the numbers, and it's very humbling. I'm kind of becoming some type of star, not just in the United States, but kind of around the world. And just appreciate the opportunity, and I appreciate all those fans out there that are listening.
Ron Fuller's Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, I'm the great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.